Episode 101. La 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 abracapocus. It's spring in Patuxent Village. 60 degrees. Greetings and welcome into the Patuxent General. March roared right into our little village. We've had cold, snow, wind, sun, and rain, so change is the word, I guess? Orange-red cardinals can be clearly spied in the bush across the street. Recently, we've discussed correlations between Rhode Island and several distinguished writers of the mysterious, and over the next two episodes, we will take on Houdini and how Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the spiritualist movement, and H.P. Lovecraft affected his life and perhaps his death. Today, we will discuss his favorite dishes and walk through two of his own published recipes. Then, in our House on the Corner series, we are going to start the reading of Under the Pyramids by H.P. Lovecraft for Harry Houdini. Harry came to Howard with some basic ideas of ways to incorporate some of his acts into story form. He then paid H.P. to write this story, which may just be straight publicity on Harry's part, but what resulted is a very interesting piece of Lovecraft work. I can't wait to dive into it with you, but first, I would like to thank our Patreon subscribers. These harbingers of change are the icy rain glistening in the fire smoke scented breeze dripping off the swaying wire, comforting the cozy community that is the Patuxent General, without whom we would be stuck in the middle of deepest winter. Ooh. If you would like to be a cardinal or bluebird of happiness and join our Patreon subscribers, simply follow the links in the show notes, however you are listening, or check on our page on patreon.com, where a small donation makes all this possible. So thank you! But until then, let's talk about Harry Houdini's scalloped mushrooms and deviled eggs. Edgar Arthur William Howard and Harry, all mysterious and connected to the spiritual movement and each other. We've been following these connections for some time, but now let's look into the relationship between H.P. Lovecraft and Harry Houdini. And we are going to listen to the story that they wrote together. But first, let's discuss our snack and drink and their connection to Harry Houdini. Feel free to crack open a cold beer. I'll explain why. Eric Weiss, which is Harry Houdini's born name, grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin. His father was a rabbi there, where the family had immigrated from Budapest, Hungary. Appleton itself celebrated the great Houdini by creating a short-run beer in his honor.
Houdini, break the bonds of ordinary beer. Fox Classic.
Why beer for such a staunch teetotaler like Houdini, who actually said,
I don't drink, smoke, or chew.
Well, it does make sense if you consider that he was hired by Tetley to do his milk can escape only filled with beer instead of water. It went over so well, in fact, that Houdini did the promotion all over, also with milk. In fact, he even did one here in Providence, Rhode Island. The Hanley Brewing Company promoting Hanley's Peerless Ale had him appear in 1915, one of a long string of beer promotions stretching around the world from 1911 with Tetley until 1916 in Dayton, Ohio at the Ohio Brewing Company. So while you relax with that, let's talk about Houdini and food. Harry adored his mother. He paid close attention to her cooking, and this fed his love for food in general. When things were tight, he cooked, and when he was flush, he ate out all over the world. He became well known for his palate as well. So, he was included in multiple cookbooks. Today, we are using one of them. The Stag Cookbook, A Man's Cookbook for Men, by C. Mac Sheridan. Houdini's dish has two parts and is served together for a lovely lunch or light supper, when mushrooms are in season or any time you want lunch like Houdini and Lovecraft. scalloped mushrooms and deviled eggs, the mushroom dish. Choose for this purpose fine, firm ones. Pick, wash, wipe, and peel. Then lay them in a deep pudding dish well buttered. Season them with pepper and salt, and add a little onion. Sprinkle each layer with rolled breadcrumbs. Dot with small pieces of butter, and proceed in this way until the dish is full, having the top layer of breadcrumbs. Bake in a moderate oven. The eggs. Boil the eggs hard. Remove shells and cut the eggs in half, slicing a bit off the ends to make them stand upright. Extract the yolks and rub them to a smooth paste with melted butter, cayenne pepper, a touch of mustard, and a dash of vinegar. Fill the hollowed whites with this and send to the table upon a bed of chopped lettuce or watercress, seasoned with salt, pepper, vinegar, and a little sugar. Next week, as we continue with our special two-part Houdini-Lovecraft combo, we'll cover Harry's favorite dish of all time, chicken paprikash, and his wife Bess's custard bread pudding with Bing cherries.
I want to tell you about my friend Mike and his electromagnetic pinball museum and restoration arcade. It's an all-inclusive place to relax and share anything related to modern pinball, EM pinball, and arcade games. A group of pinball and arcade fans with an addiction to games of all kinds and Lego too. $10 gets you free play on pinball and arcade games all day. You can find them at 881 Main Street, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or online at www.electromagneticpinballmuseum.com.
The House on the Corner. Now we start a very interesting story. It goes by many names. It started as Under the Pyramids, was then published as Imprisoned with the Pharaohs in Weird Tales in 1924, and then reprinted in 1939 as Entombed with the Pharaoh. But by any of those names, it is still the ghost-written and later acknowledged collaboration between Harry Houdini and H.P. Lovecraft. This authenticates the closeness between the two men professionally, which may have developed into a friendship which became life-threateningly dangerous for Harry Houdini. Let us enjoy Under the Pyramids. Mystery attracts mystery. Ever since the wide appearance of my name as a performer of unexplained feats, I have encountered strange narratives and events which my calling has led people to link with my interests and activities. Some of these have been trivial and irrelevant, some deeply dramatic and absorbing, some productive of weird and perilous experiences, and some involving me in extensive scientific and historical research. Many of these matters I have told and shall continue to tell freely, but there is one of which I speak with great reluctance and of which I am now relating only after a session of grilling persuasion from the publishers of this magazine, who had heard vague rumors of it from other members of my family. The hitherto guarded subject pertains to my non-professional visit to Egypt 14 years ago, and has been avoided by me for several reasons. For one thing, I am averse to exploiting certain unmistakably actual facts and conditions, obviously unknown to the myriad tourists who throng about the pyramids, and apparently secreted with much diligence by the authorities at Cairo, who cannot be wholly ignorant of them. For another thing, I dislike to recount an incident in which my own fantastic imagination must have played so great a part. What I saw, or thought I saw, certainly did not take place, but is rather to be viewed as a result of my then-recent readings and of speculations innate in the theme which my environment naturally prompted. These imaginative stimuli, magnified by the excitement of an actual event, terrible enough in itself, undoubtedly gave rise to the culminating horror of that grotesque night so long past. In January 1910, I had finished a professional engagement in England and signed a contract for a tour in Australian theaters. A liberal time for being allowed for the trip, I determined to make the most of it by a sort of travel which chiefly interests me. So, accompanied by my wife, I drifted pleasantly down the continent and embarked at Marseille on the P&O steamer Malois, bound for Port Said. From that point, I proposed to visit the principal historical localities of Lower Egypt before leaving finally for Australia. The voyage was an agreeable one, and enlivened by many of the amusing incidents which befell a magical performer apart from his work. I had intended, for the sake of quiet travel, to keep my name a secret, but was goaded into betraying myself by a fellow magician whose anxiety to astound the passengers with ordinary tricks tempted me to duplicate and exceed his feats in a manner quite destructive of my incognito. I mention this because of its ultimate effect, an effect I should have foreseen before unmasking to a shipload of tourists about to scatter throughout the Nile Valley. What it did was to herald my identity wherever I subsequently went, and deprive my wife and me of all the placid inconspicuousness we had sought. Traveling to seek curiosities, I was often forced to stand inspection as a sort of curiosity myself. We had come to Egypt in search of the picturesque and the mystically impressive, but found little enough when the ship edged up in Port Said and discharged its passengers into small boats, small dunes of sand, bobbing buoys in the shallow water, and a dreary European small town with nothing of interest to save the great Dileep statue, made us anxious to get on with something more worth our while. After some discussion, we decided to proceed at once to Cairo and the pyramids, later going to Alexandria for the Australian boat and for whatever Greco-Roman site that ancient metropolis might present. The railway journey was tolerable enough and consumed only 4 hours and a half. We saw much of the Suez Canal, whose route we followed as far as Ismailia, and later had a taste of old Egypt in our glimpse of the restored freshwater canal of the Middle Empire. Then we saw at last Cairo glimmering through the growing dusk, a twinkling constellation which became ablaze as we halted at the great Gare Centrale. But once more disappointment awaited us, for all that we beheld was European, save the costumes and the crowd. The prosaic subway led to a square teeming with carriages, taxicabs, and trolley cars, and gorgeous with electric lights shining on tall buildings, whilst the very theater where I was vainly requested to play, and which later I attended as a spectator, had recently been renamed the American Cosmograph. We stopped at Shepherd's Hotel, reached in a taxi that sped along the broad, smartly built-up streets, and amid the perfect service of its restaurant, elevators, and generally Anglo-American luxuries, the mysterious East and immemorial past seemed very far away. The next day, however, precipitated us delightfully into the heart of the Arabian Nights atmosphere, and in the winding ways and exotic skyline of Cairo, the Baghdad of Harun al-Rashid seemed to live again. Guided by our Baedeker, we had struck east past the gardens along the Muskai in quest of the native quarter, and were soon in the hands of a clamorous cicerone who, notwithstanding later developments, was assuredly a master at his trade. Not until afterward did I see that I should have applied at the hotel for a licensed guide. This man, a shaven, peculiarly hollow-voiced and relatively cleanly fellow, who looked like a pharaoh and called himself Abdul Reis El Drogman, appeared to have much power over others of his kind, though subsequently the police professed did not know him, and to suggest that Rice is merely a name for any person with authority, whilst Drogman was obviously no more than a clumsy modification of a word for a leader of tourist parties, Drogelman. Abdul led us through such wonders as we before had only read or dreamed of. Old Cairo is itself a storybook and a dream. Labyrinths of narrow alleys redolent with aromatic secrets. Arabesque balconies and aureoles nearly meeting above the cobbled streets. Maelstroms of oriental traffic and strange cries. Cracking whips, rattling carts, jingling money and braying donkeys. Kaleidoscopes of polychrome robes. Veils, turbans and tarbishes. Water carriers and dervishes. Dogs and cats, soothsayers and barbers, and over all the whining of blind beggars crouched in alcoves, and the sonorous chantings of muezzins in the minarets limned delicately along the sky of deep, unchanging blue. The roofed, quieter bazaars were hardly less alluring. Spice, perfume, incense, beads, rugs, silks, and brass. Old Mamun Suleiman squats cross-legged amongst the gummy bottles, while chattering youths pulverize mustard and a hollowed-out capital of an ancient glass column, a Roman Corinthian, perhaps from neighboring Heliopolis, where Augustus stationed one of his three Egyptian legions. Antiquity begins to mingle with its ecstaticism. And then the mosques and the museums. We saw them all and tried not to let our Arabian revel succumb to the darker charm of pharaonic Egypt with all the museum's priceless treasures offered. That was to be our climax. And for the present, we concentrated on the medieval Saracenic glories of the caliphs whose magnificent tomb mosques form a glittering fairy necropolis on the edge of the Arabian desert. At length, Abdul took us along the Saria Muhammad Ali to the ancient mosque of Sultan Hassan and the tower-flanked Bab el-Azeb, beyond which climbs the steep-walled pass to the mighty citadel which Saladin himself built with the stores of forgotten pyramids. It was sunset when we scaled that cliff, circled the modern mosque of Muhammad Ali, and looked down from the dizzying parapet over the mystic Cairo. Mystic Cairo, all golden with its carven domes, its ethereal minarets, and its flaming gardens. Far over the city towered the great Roman dome of the new museum, and beyond it, across the cryptic yellow Nile that is the mother of eons and dynasties, lurked the menacing sands of the Libyan desert, undulant and iridescent and evil with older arcana. The red sun sank low, bringing the relentless chill of Egyptian dusk, and as it stood poised on the world's rim, like that ancient god of Heliopolis, Ra Harakhate, the horizon sun, we saw silhouetted against the vermeil holocaust the black outlines of the pyramids of Giza. The Paleogean tombs there were hoary and with a thousand years when Tut-ankh-Amun mounted his golden throne in distant Thebes. Then we knew we were done with the Saracen Cairo, and that we must taste the deeper mysteries of primal Egypt, the black Khem of Ra and Amun, Isis and Osiris. Thank you once again for joining us today at the Patuxet General. If you'd like to reach out with a recipe, comment, question, order, or a local ghost story, our email is jess@patuxetgeneral.com. Please reach out. We can't wait to hear from you, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. But until then, we'll meet you right back here next time at the Patuxet General. A Something for Posterity production, pre-recorded in Patuxet.